Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Toddcast. So the field to take on former President Trump in the 2024 primary keeps growing bigger. And this week, the latest major challengers are three men, two of whom were once among the closest allies of Mr. Trump. His own former vice president is out with his official video announcement this morning, not mentioning his old running mate by name, but making clear his calls for new leadership.
And it'd be easy to stay on the sidelines, but that's not how I was raised. That's why today, before God and my family, I'm announcing I'm running for president of the United States.
And the former head of the Trump White House transition, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, once thought of as a leading contender to be Trump's running mate in 16, or even attorney general, is taking an even more direct aim at him as he makes his run for president official Tuesday night at a town hall in New Hampshire.
It is the last throes of a bitter, angry man who wants power back for himself, not for you.
Christie and Pence are entering a crowded field. At least a dozen Republicans are now fighting for the party's nomination, including now North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, who is announcing his bid in a Wall Street Journal op-ed midweek Wednesday. So to break it all down, I'm joined by Amy Walter, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Cook Political Report, with Amy Walter, and Michael Cruz, who's a senior staff writer at Politico and has spent a lot of individual time with many of these candidates. Amy and Michael, welcome back to the Toddcast.
Thanks, Chuck.
Thanks, Chuck.
Pence and Christie, they're both enablers, original enablers, and at the same time, in theory, ought to be critics that should have an impact. And yet it feels like this is going to get a lot more attention from us than the voters. Amy, am I right?
That's a really good way to think of that. And part of their challenge in being the enablers is that it's really hard to be taken seriously as a critic. And there's a reason that Chris Christie has the highest unfavorables among all the Republicans running right now. It's that he's seen as somebody who was with Trump until he decided not to be. He's a now member, firmly a member of the anti-Trump or never Trump resistance. Mike Pence, you guys have heard these focus groups, listened to voters talking about Mike Pence. It's not that they dislike him, but they just don't see a rationale for his candidacy. And so I feel like the two of them, you're right, they are doing the thing that the media would like to see more of, which is taking Trump on directly. But I don't know that that's what Republican voters want to see. And if they do want to see it, it's from a different type of messenger. I don't know that they take the messenger as seriously as the message.
No, I don't see how any of this, if any of them are successful, I assume it just helps Tim Scott or Ron DeSantis, mm-hmm. right, Michael Cruz?
Mm-hmm. I think Mike Pence and Chris Christie both were more viable presidential candidates in 2012. Both pretty well positioned in 2012.
To this day, I actually think if Pence had jumped in, he was a one-term governor at the time, he was really close to running, he would have, unlike Santorum, he would have beaten Romney in that, that moment.
And a totally different Republican Party. I mean, yep. Better positioned at that time. And Chris Christie, too. I do think the difference, though, between Christie and Pence is that Christie is a better pugilist. I mean, he has mm-hmm. more capacity to take this attack to Trump. Yeah, I think we overestimate just how much even Republican primary voters remember back to 4, 6, 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. And if nothing else, it will be, I think, compelling, entertaining, and not just for us. I mean, for people who go to these kinds of events, who watch these events on or highlights of these events on TV in New Hampshire for Christie, perhaps Pence in Iowa.
But it just feels like going to watch a Morning Joe broadcast in person.
Which
right? I mean, isn't that what the Christie Town Hall is going
to
be?
Listening to that Christie Town Hall,
right?
That's exactly what I thought, which is, look, he got laugh lines for every Trump attack, right?
Do we think a single Republican primary voter was in the audience?
Yeah, there were a couple of them. 10% of the electorate has been unhappy with Trump. That to me is the question. But I think Michael raises the good point, which is it that he's such a good pugilist that he gets that chink in the armor that somebody else can exploit? I don't know if that's the right.
He also said, I mean, this needs to be said. Chris Christie said the only way to win this Republican primary is to take it to Trump and to go through Trump. That's the lane. And so you have to do it, whether you're Christie, by the way, Pence, Nikki Haley, anybody.
I agree with him. He's just the worst possible person to put in that lane. Like, literally, I want to go in the fast lane with a broken down Toyota Corolla.
Well, who else is going to do it, Chuck?
You're right.
That's what Ron DeSantis was supposed to be.
Right.
And we still have not seen whether he will do it or whether he can do it or whether he'll be seen. He comes into the race at least with the credibility among Republican voters. They are willing to listen to what he has to say, but how's he going to do it? Right now it's been kind of oblique, but
I mean, the Christie has a technical problem, which is, I don't know how he keeps a campaign funded and, you know, and can even make the debate stage. Like, he's got logistical work that I don't know if he's got the infrastructure to pull it off, but we're going to find out. Doug Burgum is the candidate I'm most intrigued about because he really is the reincarnation of Mitt Romney 2012. If Mike Pence, Doug Burgum, successful businessman, McKinsey in his background. I mean, he's made his money on the tech side of things. Wasn't for mandates, but cried during COVID over the debate about masks and how it was a very powerful. It was one of the few moments that stuck out to me. During COVID among individual governors, you know, the governor of Idaho and the governor of North Dakota, both of whom had their members of their own parties attacking them for just being compassionate. Burgum is the guy I'm intrigued by because he's making a character argument and has the credibility to do it. The other two don't.
I think he's trying to run. I mean, listen, I'm
trying here.
I know you are.
And here's why I am. Because Doug Burgum's the type of candidate we all say we want to have run. He's a good man, seems like a good character, seems like, you know, and yet the guy, we're all sitting here going, guy, the guy's got no chance. Yet he's the one that is like the Boy Scout. And we're just totally dismissed.
Chuck, do you need me to go out to North Dakota and profile Doug Burgum?
I can't believe you're not there yet. I think he's sort of, I mean, we're taking Vivek Ramaswamy seriously.
Why not Doug Burgum?
And by the way, he's got more money than Vivek.
Both of them are trying to be the... And you said the Mitt Romney. I would argue more like the Donald Trump, but without the Donald Trump
character. Whatever that means.
Character, right.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is, we don't need any more traditional politicians. We need these folks who were business people first, who made their living outside of politics. Everybody else in this field is a political hack. I am not. All I want to do is get people working again, be optimistic about America, really live American values, flyover country needs to be at the center of the conversation. So I think in that sense, it's this sort of breath of fresh air.
Yeah.
But again, and it could stand out in a field of politicos, but is that what Republican primary voters want? We keep hearing over and over again, Chuck, all they want is a fighter.
I agree.
We want a fighter. We want somebody
Everybody is selling cat food to people who want dog food.
This is a two-person primary. Arguably, it's a one-person primary. Mm-hmm. But let's just say it's a two-person primary until it's not. Until something happens. I don't know what that would be. I'm not holding my breath. But it's not inconceivable, non-zero chance that something happens to sort of disrupt this reality. And at that point, maybe Christie, Pence, Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, Doug Burgum look a little bit different, sit in a totally scrambled field. Until then, I just don't see how that general dynamic changes.
We've had a lot of candidates announced this month. Isn't this a reflection around DeSantis, not Donald Trump, Amy?
Yeah, that he no longer looks as scary as he did earlier on.
He's in pole position, but he doesn't look strong.
That's right. And that everybody else thinks they're going to find that vulnerability of Trump that we thought Ron DeSantis had found, right? Which was the electability. I'm Trump without the baggage. And that doesn't seem to be getting much traction. And so now everybody else is out there trying to find what is that. Now I have the angle, right? I'm going to be the businessman with the optimistic look on America. I'm going to go in as the pugilist who's willing to punch Trump in the face. I'm going to go in, Mike Pence saying, it's my turn, number one. But two, the Republican Party is this conservative party. I'm taking it back from Donald Trump. All of them think they're going to be making those moves. At the same time, Chuck, didn't we always assume that, I mean, we always assumed Mike Pence was going to get in. So the real surprise, I guess, is Christie. What would surprise me even more is if someone that we've been talking about a lot, you and I, especially Chuck, like Brian Kemp said,
right,
you know what? This is a joke. I'm getting in. But they're not. So I don't know that we're seeing big heavyweights get in.
You know, here's the who, it's
could,
funny,
who
it's,
could actually do the
It's real. Funny you bring up Brian Kemp. Brian Kemp, Michael, has the best credentials of anybody to be both pro-Trump and how to defeat Trump. Mm-hmm. Nobody else has done
that. Correct that code.
Mm-hmm. It is. I don't know whether it's transferable, which I think if he thought it was transferable, I don't think Brian Kemp has the personality to make it transferable. I mean, I think that's the issue there. I think he's like Ron DeSantis a bit. He's a little technocratic in his style, which I think did benefit him during that fight with Trump and would hurt him in an actual campaign with Trump. But maybe I'm overanalyzing.
You know, in retrospect, if Ron DeSantis could have started running for president the morning after his reelection win, that probably would have been.
I completely agree. Shuts everybody else out. Tim Scott doesn't run.
For sure. Incredibly strong. I mean, he seemed to be shot out of a rocket coming out of the reelect. There was a moment, I think we've already forgotten, there was a moment like 4 to 6 weeks where Trump was sort of teetering and DeSantis was utterly ascendant.
By the way,
changed.
Imagine January. I've thought about this. Imagine had he announced January 20th, right? Made it on that. We had just been a few days removed from the chaos of electing a speaker. Washington Republicans looked chaotic. Trump looked weak, right? DeSantis, I threw this scenario by somebody who made this argument to DeSantis, and they said no. They said, let's wait. And because this person is convinced, Michael, that he would have had 100 endorsements from House Republicans immediately. There'd have been a coalescing because of the moment Republicans looked like they were in. McCarthy looked extraordinarily weak.
The perception was very different at that time, but Ron DeSantis was still Ron DeSantis. And I think he still perhaps gets a little bit too much credit for having been this Goliath. He did have a big reelection win in Florida. Noteworthy. Was running against Charlie Crist. 4 years before that, had won by 30,000 votes against Andrew Gillum, not the perfect candidate. Untested in any other congressional race, other than arguably the very first Republican primary when he first ran for Congress. Has clear assets, of course, as a political combatant, but also has obvious liabilities that I'm not sure can be overcome in the glare of a presidential campaign. He's not at all the perfect presidential candidate. He is not. And so just need to see how this plays out. I continue to be curious to watch him do the thing. He has started, of course, and it has been uneven, let's say. I'm still there is nobody else who sort of has the collection of qualities and credentials to take on Trump the way that Ron DeSantis does, but he is far, far from a flawless head-to-head candidate when it comes to Donald Trump.
But we still have yet to see the campaign actually engage, which is where I am. And if you just want to start with that, or start this conversation, you all, which is most normal people are not paying attention to any of this. And if you call a Republican primary voter on the phone and say, who are you going to vote for? Who's the person who's been at the top of your mind all time? Oh, yeah, Donald Trump. Of course, voted for Donald Trump.
Well, yeah, you actually are. Our folks are seeing it in Iowa. The first two names on everybody's head. Well, I'd like to see both Trump and DeSantis. I'll think about it.
Yeah.
But there isn't a full rejection of Trump. There just isn't.
No, there is absolutely not. So it's a, I don't know, I'll look around.
And there's appetite for Ron DeSantis. I mean, they like him out there in Iowa in particular. I mean, I was out in Iowa not too long ago for some DeSantis events, and there is absolutely curiosity about Ron DeSantis. Know his name. I've seen him on Fox News. I've listened to him on podcasts. Like what he did in Florida. You know, there is certainly DeSantis appetite.
Governor of Iowa has gone out of her way to say that they're doing things that Florida did and that they were borrowing from Florida. I mean, so it has been in that. Weaved in the political culture of Iowa, I'd argue, for a couple of years.
So is your point, Chuck and Michael, that there's just the bottom line is voters are perfectly happy
with this choice,
with this choice.
That's what
and
I
that you're trying to sell them something they don't want. And you can try all the different angles. You can try the nice, you can try pugilistic, you can try business angle, you can try all these different things. But at the end of the day, you're not going to appeal to enough people who already want Trump.
That looks that I would add a third candidate. I think there's only one other candidate right now that has a chance at traction, and it's Tim Scott, just because he has the money to surge in Iowa. Because we all know there is always a moment when candidate A and candidate B beat the crap out of each other that a candidate C can get some traction. That doesn't mean they can win, but they get some traction. And honestly, I think if you told me those are the only three candidates with, you know, maybe like a 1 week burst of interest in Vivek, and that was how the primary played out, it wouldn't surprise me.
And Tim Scott is what Republican voters, to your point earlier, Chuck, say they want.
Right. They say they want it.
They say they want it. Here he is.
And I think he will be everybody's second choice. I think he becomes the second choice candidate. I think he goes out of his way not to attack, because I also think he looks like the Kamala Harris campaign. I'm running for vice president. It looks a lot like that. He steers clear from taking many shots.
Yeah, although Kamala Harris's best moment in her campaign was the time she took a shot, but then of course did not follow through on.
Right. It was both her best and worst moment.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I've been in South Carolina. You guys, I'm sure, are hearing the same thing. Talk to voters there. Oh, we loved him, Scott.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, are you going to vote for him? No.
Probably not.
But he'd make a great vice president. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I would hear is, and I think this is.
And you do spend challenge. You spend more time in South Carolina than the average bear. Correct?
I would like
the way
to spend
I do
more
in
time.
Florida. Yeah.
There we go. Yeah. But if you, you kind of peel under that. Well, what is it that you're looking for? What in a candidate? And they said, well, why would we take a chance on someone else? Donald Trump already proved he can do the job, and I like that.
Well, you know why Tim Scott interests voters, Michael. They do see it as, you know, if he could advertise himself as trolling the left, it actually would help him.
Isn't he kind of doing that?
Well, I think it's subtle.
The line that he uses frequently, my existence disproves the left's lies.
Yes. That's his biggest applause line.
Should work. It should. I mean, it works, but it should work even better. You know, it because it's not totally wrong if you see it the way he sees it, right? And it's well delivered. And he should be polling higher if we were in a rational place, or if we are ever in a rational place in politics.
Well, and it's why it's the one person. Look, I go back to Scott and I compare him to Pete Buttigieg. In that Pete Buttigieg was first on the air, and all of a sudden he became an Iowa front runner because nobody else went on the air. Elizabeth Warren's campaign was dismissive of people that watched linear television. They thought, oh, well, all politics has shifted. And it's like, yeah, guess who still are the first voters? Old people who haven't cut the cord. And that's where I think Tim Scott's going to have. Put it this way. If it doesn't work, it's never going to work this summer, right? If he's not in by September, October, because he's on the air, he's going to stay on the air in a very sustained way. If he's not in double digits and creeping towards 20 by October, then it isn't working and it won't work. Hey, let me pause there. We'll be right back. We are sizing up all of Trump's challengers, from Chris Christie to Ron DeSantis to Vivek to Burgum, with Amy Walter and Michael Cruz. You're listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press.
If you ever needed to be persuaded that bad things can happen anywhere, then take a journey with us.
From compelling mysteries to in-depth investigations, our Dateline episodes are available as podcasts.
Follow Dateline NBC now to get new episodes every Tuesday. To listen ad-free, subscribe to Dateline Premium on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or datelinepremium.com.
Great storytelling with a twist from the true crime original.
Do we think Chris Christie and Donald Trump will ever appear in a debate together?
I mean, I take your point about the logistics and the challenges to that, especially starting late as Christie.
Let's assume Christie gets in the debate stage. Why do we think Donald Trump's showing up?
I agree. If I'm on the Trump campaign, I say there is no benefit to you doing this.
Zero.
Zero upside. And all we're doing is giving oxygen to these folks. The theory, of course, as you know, is that he won't be able to help himself and he's going to get in no matter what. And he's going to, right? He's got to prove that he's not chicken and he will be a moth drawn to a flame. Maybe. But it just assumes that he's not able to sort of control his ability to put these things on his own terms, which is what Donald Trump has always been able to do,
right?
Is take the fight on his terms.
Michael, look, you've studied him as much as anybody. I think he has the discipline to realize, why should I debate? Let them beat up Ron DeSantis without me there.
And also he will set up a different event.
Correct.
And draw the media attention that way as well. Yep. And there is no scenario in which, you know, three or four of those other candidates are able to take advantage of his void, because there will be no void. It will just be in a different venue that he himself will create. Assuming this is how it goes, I do hope that some of these other candidates find a way to make a somewhat compelling argument, because there's material to work with, that Donald Trump is ducking this. Not only is he a chicken, but this is not unrelated to the fact that he's a loser. He's a proven loser. He is a one-term president.
What voters in the Republican primary
agree
he's a proven loser?
I get it. It's a hard argument to make, but it is a necessary argument to make. And you can piggyback off of this probable scenario to try to make it. And what is the other option other than to keep trying to make it? Because it's so right there. Not only did he lose on his own, he contributed to losses of so many other candidates in so many other places that shouldn't have been losses. I mean, I understand why this argument hasn't worked yet, but I sort of reject the idea that it could never work.
I agree with. At some point, this argument's going to work. The question is, when are voters tired of losing, right? Like, I think that when do Republican voters actually agree with Mitch McConnell that they're tired of losing?
Okay, Amy. But is this an argument, Michael, to get him onto the debate stage, or this is just the argument to make to get that message of he's a loser to finally land? Because it's clear when he doesn't show up.
I'm not talking about the debate stage per se. I'm just saying that his empty podium
says it.
is an opportunity to make that argument and to make it more strongly. But this is an argument that I think these candidates, what do I know? I'm not a Republican strategist, but if I were a Republican strategist, I'd be arguing that my candidate should be making this argument more and harder, because how else are you going to take him down? Maybe I'm not thinking this like far enough around, you know, enough corners and playing chess, but my goodness, this is an extremely compelling argument. He's a loser. He has lost. Yeah. And now we need to move on and somebody has to do it. Who are we going to move on to, Republicans?
Amy, what do you make of the DeSantis 8-year versus 4-year argument? Whether voters get that,
because I would hear it in focus groups, but it feels so sort of like, again, it's like you took all of the all the stuff you heard in a focus group and you put it all into a chart.
DeSantis and you picked out like the ones. Feels like so focus group driven.
You picked out all of the things that you heard people say more than one time, right? Yeah. He's we're tired of the chaos. We like what Trump does. We like the policies, but we think he's not as effective. He could only serve. We love him, but he can only serve 4 years, right? It feels very prescriptive as opposed to organic, and I think that is at its core the challenge for DeSantis, because he's come out of this now taking three or four different of these elements and trying to find the one that sticks. It's like,
so funny.
Right, electability, that's not working as much anymore. All right, now we're going to go to the 8-year. Okay, now it's I'm going to go to the right of him on culture, and we're going to make it all about DEI and ESG and all the other acronyms.
You are so correct in how DeSantis, Michael, I don't know if you've picked this up. I know you went to try to do what you do so well, and DeSantis gave you a little bit of a Heisman there, but I know you peeled back the onion.
Depends on the profile, right? I mean, I've spent time with him, and I've chased him around the state, both those things. Yes.
Right. And yet, he feels like a consultant driven message deliverer more so than anybody else running right now.
But I think that's like a byproduct, not to be too charitable to him in this interpretation, but my read is that that is sort of an organic byproduct of the fact that he's very much a student. I mean, he's reading polling, but he's also reading white papers.
Yeah.
And say what you want about Ron DeSantis, but he is manifestly intelligent and like a real reader and a studier, and then uses that to inform his decisions and has done this for better or for worse. And so, in some ways, I feel like he's being penalized here for like being the better student.
Ask Hillary Clinton about that, right? The better debater doesn't get to win. The person better qualified doesn't always get to win. Right.
Right. Of course. Right. The comparison, the Ron DeSantis Hillary Clinton comparison. Let's start it up.
Oh, won't they love that if we make all these comparisons? But in some ways, you're absolutely right. DeSantis, just like Hillary, does her homework.
Well, for sure. And both of them. I mean, one line I've heard from time to time over the last few years with not just Ron DeSantis, but Casey DeSantis, is that they think they're the Kennedys, but they're actually the Clintons. And so, usually people refer to Casey DeSantis with the Hillary Clinton comparison. Well, but let's do Ron as well.
Well, I think if you flip, Casey has the personality, right? So Casey is Bill in this case, and Ron is Hillary.
Maybe. Although loosely.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah. You try too hard and suddenly it falls apart. The metaphor can fall apart. What do you think the White House is doing right now when they look at this race, Amy? Do they just sit there and say, my God, this reelect is coming together. This should be a disaster and it's not. Thank you, Donald Trump. Is it that simple?
I would think so. I mean, they're betting the farm, it seems, on the 2022 campaign module, right? And it's like, we're going to take this, plug it into 24.
It worked in 22, exactly, and they think it's going to,
it's going to absolutely,
again.
And it's MAGA, and it's Trump, and, there's not one place that Trump lost in 2020 that he's going to be able to win in 2024. And that all sounds fine and plausible. And yet, man, when you have an electorate that is so dispirited about the choices
in
front of them.
Yeah, dispirited is a good word.
It creates, and we've talked about this, Chuck, before, you and I have, about all the other elements here that go beyond just facing up against Donald Trump. Third-party candidates, whether it's this unity ticket or whether it's,
Cornel West
getting on a ballot in Arizona, or a Green Party challenge in, Nevada. Just, it's not going to take, if we know that what the vote is sort of locked in, move 2,000 of those, you've got the locked in vote, and then you've got a handful of votes that are malleable, and those move in other places.
My fear for Biden, Michael, is that he's starting to look like Hillary 16. He looks more like Hillary 16 than Biden 20. And he looks a lot more like Gore 2000 as well. Like if you put him in there, which is, they're good enough, but there is just enough doubt about them that it eats away just enough vote that costs you a state here or costs you a state there. It's what happened to Gore in 2000 with Ralph Nader and with a sort of demoralized left who, God, Clinton, I don't know, right? There was a divide over him. And then with Hillary, same thing for different reasons.
We pick presidents at this point, thanks to the votes of tens of thousands of people in a few suburbs and a few states. The idea that Joe Biden beat Donald Trump in 2020, therefore, surely that's the way it will turn out if that's the choice in the election to come is, I think, wrongheaded, slightly different dynamics, and it's so close that it's basically a toss-up at all times. And in my conversations with many Republican consultants over the last however many months, the prospect of a general election between Joe Biden and Ron DeSantis is much more attractive to them. I mean, they're not 100%. Representative, but they, you know, just from an optics standpoint, if the average voter tunes in September of next year and says, "Okay, who's running for president? Who are the right. who are my choices?
Here's the young guy veteran, right?
And here's Ron DeSantis with his three little kids and with Casey by his side, and these are the two people on this stage." I mean, it sort of goes back to the when are Republican voters going to get tired of losing part of this conversation. Like, that is a much more attractive contrast,
right?
I would think, for the average, barely informed or even reasonably informed Republican voter and sort of what's left of the middle voter. Right. And the idea of a Joe Biden Donald Trump rematch, set aside like all sort of political considerations, policy differences. No, thank you, says the entirety of the United States of America. Nobody wants this. And I think if that is the general election choice a year from now, a year plus from now, bad news. Like, you know, I hesitate to say like what will happen, but I completely agree.
There's unintended consequences to this that we don't fully realize understand. Yet. We don't fully get yet, but I agree with you. It's inevitable. But Republicans and the electability, when was the last time they cared about in a primary, Amy, where voters cared about it enough to actually vote on it?
You know, I do think that was sort of Mitt Romney's pitch.
It was. And it didn't work.
And it actually worked. And it's why Donald Trump won in 2016. Because they said, you know, John McCain was also the electable guy. You told us, you got to vote for John McCain. Yeah. He's going to win. Oh, now we got to vote for Mitt Romney. He's the only guy that can win independent. Why do we have to take these mushy, rhino-y establishment candidates? Let's take a risk with this guy. What's the worst that can happen? We lose? So what? We've been losing anyway. And so that argument, it's also really hard to make an electability argument when the only thing separating Donald Trump from a second term was about 40,000 votes. In three states. Now, how hard is it to find 40,000 votes?
This goes back to something Tommy Thompson said to me in Wisconsin, which is about Wisconsin's polarization, which is nobody loses by enough to make change.
Yep.
When you only lose by a little bit, you think, oh, all I needed was one more day in the trail, one more TV ad, one more whatever it is.
We should have done that rally.
How
do those 40,000 people find themselves now thinking about Joe Biden?
Right. That's a great,
Now, what Democrats would argue, Chuck, as you know, is that there is not one Biden voter today who would say, you know what? I made a mistake. I should have voted for Trump, and I'm going to vote for Trump.
But it's not about whether they will switch votes.
It's not about that. It's are they going to show up?
That's what I was just going to say. It's not about whether they vote for Trump. They're not voting for Trump.
Exactly. So do they stay home? Yep. And where do some of these issues – again, I really hate fighting the last war, which is what
– Well, and then there's abortion.
Like abortion.
Which
could end up – we're going to ride abortion with young
voters. And by the way, it might work.
Maybe.
You know, that 6 week in Florida may be really, maybe forget everything else we're talking about Ron DeSantis. That may be the single biggest thing he did to prevent himself from getting to the Oval Office. That's what we may write in the history books 10 years from now. All right, I got to end it there. You guys are great.
Too dramatic not to end it there, Chuck.
You've been listening to the Chuck Todcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Justice Gilpin Green, Elias Miller, and Kamlavi Adism. Our theme music is composed by Spoke Media. Meet the Press Now is live every day at 4 p.m. Eastern on NBC News Now. You can watch it anywhere, YouTube, meetthepress.com, or simply Google NBC News Now, and it pops up for you. And of course, the big show is available every Sunday, wherever you get your NBC News program. So thanks for listening, and until we upload again.